as one book, the chapter of the book closes, another one hasn't opened yet, but then the authors of the book kick in your window. They smash in through the window and they say, hey, reading the book, huh? Which part
That's
did you get
my favorite
to?
Part of reading any Stephen King book, when there's a knock on the door and I'm like, yeah, and he's like, how far have you gotten?
Did you get to the part where the car eats the guy? Anyway, we're here to ask you if you've gotten yet to the part where the car eats the guy in Tazzy Thirsty Season 1. And this is everybody's favorite talk show done by the guys who do the actual show. It's the Adventure Zone Zone. And we're all here
to
talk
about it. Back again, haters.
Back again. Please don't hate it. That's the first thing, I guess.
Here, wait. Let me rephrase that. Back again, lovers.
No, that's not.
That's
not
bad
either.
Too.
No, that's bad.
We're gonna talk about season one of Taz Ether. See, we got about a billion questions here. It's been, I will say, a while since we wrapped up. We recorded a bunch of Ether Seas to have them in the chamber, so I could have a bit of time to relocate myself and my family across the country. But I think it's still fresh enough in our gourds.
Do we want to save like the reveal for what we're doing next?
Yeah, we'll talk
about
it.
Yeah, of course. Or else people won't listen.
That's
the only reason people listen to this show.
That was my
way of
like,
you are.
Oh, so, yeah. So sad.
We're hooking them. Yes. Hooking them.
Love that. Can we never do this on T-Taz. But how are y'all feeling now that we're, you know, about a month and a half out from recording the last episode about finishing up the first season of Ethersea?
Well, I think you've answered one big question right off the bat by calling it season one.
Yeah.
So there will be more.
Well, we've been pretty straightforward about that.
Yeah, but not to me. Nobody told me.
Well, we only talk to you when we're legally required to by creative law. I would say I feel it's interesting because this was also the first time that we did, you know, like a quiet year and did the world building together. And it's interesting to me because I have a similar feeling that I did when we finished Quiet Year and went into Ethersea, which was like, there's so much possibility now. Like, I feel we've never really done a like chapter, like kind of, you know, seasonal arc with our Adventure Zones before. And it's interesting because it feels like it was a complete season, but there's so many more things now that I want to do with it, you know?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm happy with the way that season one wrapped up and the choices that y'all made and kind of the weird and sort of abstract ending that your characters and the world itself kind of had at the end of that first season. Like, it is not hard for me to think of what we could do with a season two, like the ways that we could build off the ways that the world changed and sort of what potential still remains there. That said, I am loving not DMing. It's a sweet treat every time you get that little, you get the chance to kick up your feet.
It's sort of like a boat, you know, like buying a boat and selling a boat, where like the second most fun you have DMing is like that first session, and the most fun you have is right after finishing the last one.
Yeah. Juice, Dad, how about y'all?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a cool world. I realized that I was starting to come up against my limits of how much mythology I could keep in my head at one time.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because we created such a broad world at the beginning. Like, it started out feeling very big in scope. Like, it started out with like so much to sort of like know and keep track of. And it was easier for me once I sort of like just dialed in on the character and like she only needed to be an expert in the things that she would interact with. And like, but, before that, when it was like, I needed to keep all of the like secretly, that's part of why like Amber always pushed to like stay out of, conflicts with like the government and other authority figures and everything like that. Is because I had a little trouble like remembering how all the politics worked.
Yeah, right.
So I just I just said that she doesn't like politics.
It got much easier to keep that stuff straight when you all either murdered or sort of led to the unintentional deaths of pretty much all of the city government leaders.
Yeah, we cleaned up a lot of excess storylines there, I would say. Just trimmed, wrapped those
a lot of red tape, so to speak.
Well, it was really interesting. You know, we've been playing together for many, many years now, but I think Ether C really highlighted for me the difference between the sort of information that Justin and I are able to hold into our separate heads at separate times. Like, at any given point, I could lay out for you big, broad scope, what's going on, who hates who, why are we here, right? But then you said, like, yeah, but right now in this scene, what are you trying to do? And I'm like, oh, I don't know.
I feel like Dad is the best at keeping all the big picture.
Well, Dad writes things down.
Well, that was the key for me. I kept I called it Zook's log. Now, I just had this notebook, and I started writing stuff down in it. And originally, it was just to write down names so I could look them up. But it also became a log of jokes, and it is very important because this is the official record of the 7 rules of Ether Sea.
Oh, wow.
So far.
That's so hard to do. Like, it's hard for everybody, right? But, like, you are really talking about splitting your mind in twain when you're like, I need to keep the character stuff straight. Like, I need to be my character and portray them moment to moment. But you're also trying to keep all of this character's real world knowledge in your head. And also the mechanics you want of Dungeons and Dragons you need to be thinking about. And also, can you please make it entertaining and funny? What I'm saying is we are stunning talents, like, sure, honestly, once in a generation.
I wanted to say, and I'm curious, this is my big takeaway for the season. This season, I tried more than ever to not prepare shit and see where the story took us. And I would say that led to a pretty challenging finale, like trying to find a way to make it coherent and satisfying in you know, whatever ways that we possibly could. It was tough trying to figure out a way to do that. I think my biggest takeaway for this season was I love doing it that way. I love the, like, fully, not fully, but more improvisational, big picture storytelling stuff. I do think this is the last season I will want to run that has a mission-based structure. That has a, obviously, that was like the whole conceit of the freelance. You know, you guys are contractors and you get to pick your jobs. Right. And that was very cool. But I also feel like it is hard to do that structure with that kind of storytelling and make it coherent. So, like, I think next time I do run a season, I do not want it to be like you guys taking on different jobs. I would be curious what it would look like if you all were just on a quest and how you went about it was up to you, and the way that the path changes is entirely determined by play. Like, I would be very interested how that would go.
I will say, sorry to answer your question, because you asked about the more open-ended structure. I will say that it was, the only thing that was challenging about it is, like, you know, when you go into a movie and you, like, read the tagline of the poster and you, like, have the vaguest idea of what the movie is.
Mm-hmm.
When we were doing these more open-ended things, you know, compared to Balance, where, like, you sort of knew that you were doing a Fast and Furious, or you kind of knew that you're doing an Agatha Christie thing, whatever it is, we were sort of, like having the agency to sort of decide along with you what kind of thing it's going to be was pretty intimidating at first. I mean, it's because it's like, I didn't know what kind of, is this the kind of vibe where, like, I can kill someone, or is it not that kind of, are we doing, being sneaky? You know, like, you know, having it be open-ended like that, I felt like a lot more confident about the midpoint of each arc where I was like, okay, I know what it is. I know what we're doing. Like, let's go from there, which isn't, like, bad or good. It's just a different sort of, that freedom made for a different sort of challenge.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's do questions. Travis, did you have one you wanted to lead off with?
Yeah, let's just start with the first one, because I like it. This is from a listener who asked, how surprised was Griffin when that Nat 1 was rolled? I assume you mean the Nat 1 that Dad brought the sallow back with us? Is that that one? Was that planned to be something the party would have to deal with as an in-game threat, or is it something that would have happened without the one being rolled?
It would not have happened without the one being rolled. That was like, I had a few of the bigger beats that we kind of touched on in the Quiet Year setup episodes that were sort of attached to those, that random encounter table. And I wanted the one to be like pretty bad. And for me, that was the sallow. Like for me, that was the way that the sallow comes back is if you do as bad a roll on this board that incorporates like these different gameplay mechanics, then I would hit you with the sallow. I did not think it would be. Was that the second roll? Was that the second
Believe
random
that's
encounter?
Right. That feels right.
Yeah,
to
no,
me.
I genuinely, I didn't like that was happening then, because it was like we are still, you know, this crew is still coming together and we're still kind of getting our footing with this season. But at the same time, like there is no way we could have re-rolled that. There is that would have betrayed, I think, the whole, you know, the whole ethos that we were going for with we didn't fake a single roll this season. I feel very good about that.
You know what I found really interesting about it?
What?
Was like we set out at the beginning saying like these are just three regular people. These are not like three chosen ones. These are not like three, you know, epic beings. And then it was like those kinds of roles were like, well, now hold on. Right? Because we had to do all of it like it came so early and so big, and us dealing with that shit and being tied to it made the characters more important to the set. Like, I mean, there were character choices made and there was stuff that we did, but there was stuff like that where it's like the story is going to move quicker than Griffin had planned.
There was
and
also
that was really interesting.
There was an element of like writing a check about a like pandemic storyline. And then, like, looking at that check and being like, I do not have enough finances in my bank to cover this check to do a... because, like, I don't know. I did not want that, especially after it happened and we all kind of reacted to the role and the audience reacted to sort of the reveal. And we're like, not crazy about a pandemic storyline right now. That's not particularly fun. And so it I tried to soften that as much as I could while sort of more focusing on Cambria and that whole element of the story. But
how was it worded on your chart, on your random encounter chart? What did one say?
It said, after Dad rolls this, then
the ship inadvertently brings the sallow back to Founder's Wake.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, there it is.
Wow. And I kind of knew, like, I had this big board that had, like, what the sallow was. This, like, you know, forced fish evolution thing. And sort of tying that back into, you know, the Cambrian explosion, which was, you know, the number of people who messaged me and were like, damn, I didn't even know you were a Coheed and Cambria fan. It was not that. It was the other thing. That I, you know, had that idea in place. But yes, that was the what was on the actual table. All right. How about another question?
Okay, go ahead.
I'll do this one really quick. Griffin, did you know that this is from Sierra? Did you know that this is where the ending was going from the beginning, or did it just come to you after a few missions? It didn't. Nothing came to me, I feel like. It was entirely the choices that the boys made. I feel like I kind of figured out, like, okay, Blink Sharks, what if Blink Sharks are from like another world and we are like the vestiges that come back and wreck that world, and so they're on a mission to stop us, specifically Amber, and have that be the source of the beef, like stuff like that. But I mean, the ending that Devo had, I kind of came up with between the penultimate episode and the final episode when Travis decided to change something.
Yes.
I was like really racking my mind of like, how does that work?
I got my favorite Griffin reaction, which was when my character does something and Griffin goes, huh?
Yeah.
And like, then I'm like, oh yeah, got him.
Yeah. I mean, really all that stuff was pretty late. I did not, I had nothing planned. I really did.
And that was on purpose. So, I mean, we discussed going in. I mean, you told us going in. I don't have this big, long, you know, plot line all laid out. Let's just see where the story takes us.
Yeah, that answers a few questions. There's people who asked about, like, Devo's alternate timeline shit. Like, that was purely in the moment.
I had a question about that, because from how long out were you intending for Devo to be, like, the voice, the call and stuff like that? Was that, like, I remember, like, when we're recording that scene and, like, the machine was open and I was like, am I supposed to do it? Because I didn't want to do it if I wasn't supposed to do it. But then I was like, I think I was supposed to do it.
I think it was when I was, like, putting together the last mission. I'm trying to... Okay, so here's we re-recorded, I think, only one bit the whole season, which I feel pretty good about that hit rate. And it was I forget the specifics of it, but it was while you all were sort of investigating, you're doing the murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And there was originally this scene where you all went to confront, you thought that Orlean was at the schoolhouse. And so you go there and then there was like an explosion, which is not fun. And it kind of just got away from us a little bit. And I think the revision for that was this mission where you go to the Coral Tower where Orlean is trying to reconnect with the past, which was always kind of his arc for the season. Is that like he made some decision when he was called away that he regretted and has spent time trying to fix that. And so I think that you being the voice kind of came out of that revision, that realizing like, oh, okay, if he has a thing that he is trying to use to communicate with himself in the past, like what if, and we have this whole thing about how Devo is a convincing speaker, like those two things kind of just connected and that was it.
Amanda asked how much of Devo's section in the epilogue was planned out ahead of time. All those big reveals were figured out on the spot, Amanda. I did not know any of that, except that I do know that Devo is a CERN. Other than that, everything else was like, I'm figuring
this out.
Did
that keep in the show? You revealed in like the midnight hour. I can't remember if that, I did that make it?
Everyone else kept referencing it like in my Twitch chat and stuff. So I think so. Right.
Juice, what about this one? Did Justin have regrets about sending Amber through the portal? I feel like Amber's question of Qadira of did I make a mistake was more like Justin asking Griffin relative to the gameplay choice. Did you have a discussion after the penultimate episode about whether or not to keep that action, similar to destroying the crystal in balance, or was this not enough out of line to consider that? That's from Randy.
No, it was like I was thrilled with that. I mean, it was like you set up something that is like this character who has always been sort of like looking out for herself and in many ways sort of like fearful, you know, somebody who's making it from moment to moment and doesn't necessarily have a heroic instinct. But like they were she was like in the place at the time where her exact thing, her exact lifetime had led up to like this moment. The fact that there was like, she ran out of, she was designed to fight blink sharks. There was a door to a world full of purpose, right? Of like, she didn't have the interpersonal relationships with like so many people back home where it was like as hard of a decision. Like this is what has driven her entire life. So like, the fact that there was an opportunity to do something that would help others, like save worlds, but also like fulfill her, her individual purpose. I think it was like, I felt great about it.
What I really loved about that was that this was a moral quandary that I wanted to pose to you all in some way, right? Of like making, setting up that this world has been destroyed by this power that came from the vestiges who tried to escape from their world. Like if I pose that question to you all, would you make the same decision? And it's so cool to me how the that there was another factor that came into the into play at the very end there, right before you jumped into the portal, which is that you realized that if you did not stop Coda, Coda was going to destroy the tower, which was Zook's, right? And so if unless I'm misremembering, once you realized, like, if I don't get Coda out of here, then Zook's is going to be destroyed by Coda, you mm-hmm. jump through the portal. And I thought yeah. that was fucking rad. Like, that was it's a less sort of like explicit recognition of like how the relationships between these characters like grew and changed, because there was like animosity and not animosity, but you know, yeah. disagreements
is the word
friction like, between the characters.
Yeah.
But then when faced with like, oh, Zook's is dead if I don't do something about this, well, here we go. Like, that was the highlight of Amber's, like, I think, growth for me.
And it says more about the sacrifice coming in that regard to me. I thought, you know, show that Amber felt that she had to do what she had to do, regardless of, you know, everybody wasn't like sitting around the campfire holding hands singing Kumbaya in every episode.
I'm sorry, I always hate, in a sense, I hate talking this way because I feel like it attaches too much like introspection to the work that we do. And I'll speak for myself here that like I don't necessarily love talking about practice in this way because it's sort of like, I don't know, it seems sort of hokey to feel like I should. I like working without a net. I like making a decision in the moment that I don't exactly know what happens as a result of it, right? Like I think to a point, and this isn't just Taz, is everything. I think to a point that probably makes me tough to work with sometimes is like I get really creatively energized by throwing myself into something that like I don't actually have a path forward for. Like that's what gets me pumped. So like when I see an opportunity to do something like that where I don't know the next scene that follows it, like I will very often you know, head that way because yeah. I find it very energizing.
You like that fear, baby?
Yeah.
I do.
I have this question, and so did a lot of people, and this is from Buddy and many others. Dad, why, oh why, didn't Zooks tell Amber about his interactions with the Blink Sharks?
Well, I have two answers for that. One, I tried to play Zooks as very naive, very impressionable, and I think that became a big part of his character, the fact that he could be so easily swayed or so easily impressed by other people. And I really tried to play him like somebody who was, you know, wasn't a real deep thinker or devious. I think I tried to play him as very honest. I think I've said it before that when I was, you know, I keep things on my desk as a visual aid to help me, you know, keep the character in mind. And one of the things I've got is I've got a Funko Pop of Commander Data, you know, from Next Generation.
Is it an officially licensed Funko Pop? Because
it is a real one. Yes.
You've sent us unlicensed Funko Pop. You sent me a Mary Poppins Returns Funko Pop of Mary Poppins and also Lynn, and they were unlicensed Funko Pops, and I felt
really
very guilty. Yeah, you got them for Henry.
I thought those were licensed.
Well, then what are you bitching about?
Well, we played with him in the bath, and he called them Mommy and Daddy for a long time.
You wish, buddy.
Yeah, right.
But you know that. That childlike, you know, I tried to play that childlike. It was funny. We designed these characters completely separately, and yet, you know, there were elements of Zooks and of Devo of, you know, fresh out of the nest.
Yeah.
You know, new to the world kind of thing. But I think there was enough difference.
Yeah. But so how did that influence not telling Amber?
Okay, I went back and looked through the Zooks log that I talked about and went back to that scene, And I've got written here very clearly, don't tell. And if, I mean, if I'm remembering right, they charged Zooks with killing Amber.
Or killing all of the bleached coral, which was, yeah.
And so I don't think, they instructed him not to tell Amber. And I think that my first explanation is that he was never going to do either one of those two things.
Right.
But he didn't want to violate their trust by telling Amber. My second reason is because the one thing happened in one episode, and by the next episode, I forgot.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay. That's fair.
Okay.
So I'm just trying to go back and but I can remember being in the moment of thinking that Zooks would think, well, why tell Amber this? You know, maybe it was wrong, but I mean, I just didn't think, I don't think he gave it any credence whatsoever. So it never didn't occur to his very, you know, one plain mind at all.
I have a question here from Madison. I'm wondering how having an editor impacted the making of Ethersea. How much did or does Rachel know about the story? Do her editing decisions ever affect the course of the story? P.S. Rachel, you killed it. Love the extremely high quality of the editing, music, and sound effects. That's from Madison, she, her.
So Rachel and I had meetings sort of before the season started to talk about, because this Rachel, I think, started shortly before.
It was very close.
It was very close to the beginning of Ethersea. And so there was a lot of discussion about sort of like tone and vibe and really granular production level stuff of like in past seasons, like what have been the times that we have used music or sound design in the past, which has been like very, very, very sparing, I would say. I mean, having Rachel as an editor for all our shows has impacted, I think, all of the shows very positively in a lot of ways.
Hear, hear.
And just straight up, like, my sort of workload. Like, we had a baby, it's a boy.
You beat me to it.
Yeah, I'll never let that one go by without catching it. Also kind of around the time that I think pre-production or something like that started. The last year has been a fucking blur. Year and a half has been kind of a blur. So the timetable doesn't track a lot. In terms of like story stuff, we didn't really have like meetings about that so much after the, you know, after the Quiet Year episodes ran. Aside from, you know, Rachel and also I'll say Amanda and Sarah do a lot of like first listens, like let us know if the vibe for something is bad or if there is a story inconsistency or, you know, if we said the wrong name here or there. They are really excellent at giving us the heads up in that so that either we can fix it or they can fix it. But the story was not something that I really could even give her a big heads up on as we went, like before we started recording, because it wasn't particularly planned. And that's a tall order. I fully recognize, like, that's not usually how production and post-production works on like narrative things. And I cannot commend her enough for the work that she did under those circumstances.
Hey, a couple of quick announcements too before we get back to the episode. We've got a bunch of cool stuff over at macromerch.com. If you haven't checked it out, you need to go do that. 10% of all merch proceeds this month will be donated to Border Angels. Macromerch.com, check that out. Also, Griffin's book, The Stowaway, is out now. It's a choose your own adventure. Go to bit.ly/GriffinStowaway and get all the information there or find it at a local bookstore.
Thank you, Travis.
You're welcome, Griffin. And Justin's great too. He does cool things.
Whatever.
All right. Back to the show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Anna McLeod.
And I'm Alexis B. Preston.
And we host a show called Comfort Creatures, the show for every animal lover, be it a creature of scales, six legs, fur, feathers, or fiction. Comfort Creatures is a show for people who prefer their friends to have paws instead of hands.
Unless they are raccoon hands, that is okay.
That is absolutely okay, yeah.
Yes. Every Thursday, we will be talking to guests about their pets, learning about pets in history, art, and even fiction. Plus, we'll discover differences between pet ownership across the pond. It's going to be a hoot on Maximum Fun.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Dr. Sydney McElroy.
That is true.
It's important in this context because we host a medical history podcast called
Sawbones.
Oh, I thought we should have worked on that.
Sawbones.
Sawbones isn't afraid to ask the hard-hitting questions. Like, are vaccines as safe and reliable as they want us to believe?
Yes.
Do I have to get a flu shot?
Yes.
Okay. Is science a miracle?
No.
We have a lot of great history for you and a lot of laughs. And sometimes the history is so bad that there's no laughs. But
you'll learn something, you'll feel something.
And it's always Sawbones.
That's right.
Every week on MaximumFun.org.
I want to ask you all, Roberto asked this question specifically to Travis, but I'm curious, I think it works for all of you. At any point, did you, as a player, suspect Brother Seldom in the murder mystery at the end?
It's interesting because you mentioned the one thing we re-recorded.
Yes.
And I feel like within there, where there was a conversation where Devo like said to Orlean, like, there's only a couple of people who would be powerful enough to compel her to do something. And it would be like me or Seldom or you. So where were you? I think there was something like that that I said. And like Orlean reacted to it in a way that there was a part of my brain that was like, huh. But also, one, we didn't end up using that stuff. So I threw it out, right, of my brain.
Right.
But then also like, I want to say, and this might be just because of how often Devo squared off against him, I think Orlean is one of, like, my favorite kind of quote-unquote villains from any Taz we've done. Because, like, I didn't like him, but I also, like, every time he showed up, I'd be like, oh, fuck yeah, right? Like, there was, I loved, like, his interactions with Devo and vice versa. But so I never trusted him, but there was a certain point of like Devo, he was one of like the few people Devo had known all his life.
Yes.
So it was also like a little bit of comfortable too, which was so
I understand
weird.
That.
Yeah.
To walk through the sort of Seldom reveal, I was kind of hoping there would be another scene with Seldom where he could kind of explain, like, obviously murder is bad, folks, you don't need me to tell you that, but this like belief of, well, if Coda ever finds out where Hominine is, like, Coda will blow that city out of the sky, and so it is of the you know, if he is a whisper, which Travis kind of set up as like the spies of Hominine, protecting that information would be of the utmost importance, right? And so if the Hand of Guidance was, you know, had found out from this machine where Hominine was and wanted to sort of like reconnect with the flock, and that is why Brother Seldom did what he did, because he was afraid that if Coda finds out where the city is, he will completely destroy it. And all of the, like, you know, innocents that also live there. I also, as long as we're mentioning things that straight up weren't in the story, Jules asked, when the Coriolis crew ran into the Butt Munch / Gut Punch crew after saving the city from Cambria, it seemed implied that the Gut Punch crew had done something significant for the city as well. What were the Butt Munchers up to during the Cambria arc? Will that be as significant during the second season? Also, for the second season of Aether Sea, would you consider setting it in another contingency plan than Founder's Wake, e.g. Hominine Flying City or the Delmer City in the mountains? Okay, those two things are connected. If I have not talked to you three about this, so this will be fun. One of the like potential storyline things that I had sort of on the vision board was the Delmer necropolis, right? When the world falls, the Delmer like build a city inside of a mountain. And So there was this one mission that you all did not choose at the beginning. I think it was the Alloyed Menace. And it was, there's all this metal, all this scrap metal that keeps like showing up in this spot. And it's your job to go find out what's going on there and destroy the, you know, big beast or whatever that keeps armoring itself with this stuff. That metal was coming through like underground, like cave, river, like cenotes from the Delmer Necropolis. They are trying to like escape, but keep getting like smashed up in this cenote as they try to escape. And so like I thought that one potential arc could be finding a way to get there, which could have been like a like incredibly dangerous surface expedition to the mountains, and I don't even know what that would look like, but y'all didn't take that mission and they did. And so I had this idea of like, is there some way that at some point during the season, if we need some vine to swing to, where you all get brought in, like the gut punch has done great work to reconnect us with our kin. But it just never happened. And now I think things have kind of moved on past that chapter in Founders Wake's history. And so I think in a second season, we'll definitely want to touch on what happened with those other cities. But, I think the butt punch missed their window.
Justin, Travis, and Clint, did you find yourselves starting to conceptualize your characters during the quiet year gameplay as the world and its inhabitants were being fleshed out, or did you start that process after the prologue was done? For example, did Clint know he wanted to play a Brynar as soon as they were introduced, and how long after creating Old Joshy's school for psychic blink shark fighting did Justin decide it would be his character's alma mater? For me, I will say, and I think we all agree that Quiet Year was a blast.
Yeah.
We loved playing that game and creating that world. And just so you know, going in with any kind of intentions in that to massage things into what you want does not work. I had it just doesn't, because of the way the game plays and because you're you know, it's turn-based and people are coming up with their own ideas. The only thing I thought going in was I really wanted to play a Warforged. Started reading about Warforged when we were doing graduation, and I knew I wanted to do a Warforged. It wasn't until we got into this whole realm of it being underwater I realized, wait a minute, how is that going to work, a Warforged underwater? So I kind of put it to the back of my mind. And Griffin, you even cautioned us, don't start coming up with characters until we're done with Quiet Year.
So, I said that, you know, but also when you started talking about this idea of like coral suits,
the magic coral,
I was like, oh, yeah. Fuck yeah. Like dad's on some shit. And at that point,
when we started talking about the magic infused coral,
yeah,
I said, okay, there's a material that might work. And so that was tucked in the back of my mind. To be honest with you, I even went so far as to say Ampersand 5, I thought, hey, that'd be a cool character name. That I you know, to go with that, because you know, it was gonna be Phineas and five other Einar.
Right.
So and 5 made sense. But you know, I really tried very hard not to, because it's not possible. It's not possible to steer Quiet Year into anything.
Right.
Juice, what about your part of the question about Joshy School for Second?
I just thought that was that place seemed the most interesting to me. I found the idea really funny, and I like the idea of someone making up something and then it having like devout followers 25 years later. I think that's I think that that's really powerful.
Well, it also let us keep Joshy in the picture in a way that was
right
delightful. For me specifically, it was delightful.
Yeah, I always love scenes between Joshy and her.
Devo, it was a combination of like two card flips in Quiet Year that I got. Of like, one was like a troop of performers comes to town, and then like the religious leader comes to town that brought the Hand of Guidance.
Yeah.
And so then I started thinking about, like, what if there was a child of a member of the, like, traveling troupe that ended up being raised by the church? And, like,
I forgot about that element of it.
What?
I forgot about that element of it, that Devo was adopted from the traveling troupe. We never really circle back to that, really, at all.
Yeah. And a lot of, just because I don't know if it was ever clear, Devo's mom was with him for like 7 years at the church and then one day disappeared and the rest of the time raised by the church alone. Just because I think that there was some time, I remember saying at one point like for 17 years or something and then seeing someone be like, isn't he 23? I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, it's, oh yeah, sorry. That timeline was weird. That was why.
There's a lot of questions. I want to try and knock them all out in one sort of broad thing, asking to share like the random event table and like a campaign setting book and like all of the sheets that we use to track ship stats and vendor inventory and all that stuff. And I want to say that for the I know a lot of people asked about the random event table. I definitely want to keep using that. So maybe someday, but not. I don't want to share that right now because there's a lot of work to come up with 100 things.
Some are bad, huh?
Some are quite bad, yeah.
Well, now you got to have some duds on there,
right?
There's
some real stinkers in there. I will say that the ship like worksheet is available at bit.ly/MFD for Max Fun Drive, MFD. 2022 bonus goals, because it was a Max Fun Drive bonus goal for this past drive. So if you want to see all that stuff, and there's a lot on there, there's a lot of, I think it's also got like the different vendors and all that stuff. But I don't think anything else is ready for prime time yet.
This one was for me, and I didn't want to miss out on it because it gives me an opportunity to dunk on myself. How did you end up coming with some of Amber's lingo? Did you have specific words they came from, or were they off the dome? Guppy, I get, but what about Kappa or Clasper? That's from Ori, they, them. I thought it was a fun idea. I liked the idea of, you know, anytime there's like slang in a fantasy world, I feel like it helps it be more lived in, you know, stuff like the Mandarin and Serenity, or like the adaptations of Earth profanity that you see on like Battlestar or stuff like that. Like, I think that that is a lot of fun. So I started doing that with her, and it was like the absolute height of arrogance to think that I would be able to like keep track of that and implement it while I was recording, like, is absolutely unhinged. So it kind of fell by the wayside. Is the point that I'm making?
I don't think that's fair. I don't think it. Well, did. I still think about like Kelisai Guppy, like Kappa. Clasper is the best because Clasper. Do you want to tell what a Clasper is?
Clasper is a shark penis.
That's it.
That's it. That's what a Clasper is. It's a shark penis. Kelisai is Kela is probably nonsense. I don't know. But Sai, I am certain, came from Gunslinger. Is where like that part of, you know, you don't get to choose what parts of your brain make up words for you. So that it was Gunslinger Day that day, apparently. And I brought in Sai from that. Kappa sounds like keep up. That's why that one is the way it is. So yeah. I had intended for that to be much more robust and filled out, but it became, but I ended up
I think it was perfect the way it was, because it was like seasoning. Rather than
things like being too much, like I never had trouble keeping
too much paprika
with
on the sandwich.
Right, exactly. I loved that part of Amber's like role in the story.
Well, cool. I'm glad to hear it.
So this is a question because I wanted to talk about in the Cambria arc flashback. Did Griffin and Justin know that Justin's character would be the saboteur ahead of time from Katie?
Probably.
What are we talking about? Remind me.
When we go to Phineas's.
Yes. Yeah. Dad played Phineas and you and Travis played like Phineas's associates, and you go to Cambria's city in the bottom of the sea.
So we're going to talk about this.
I told Justin he was the saboteur before we started recording, and so tried to like back channel with him during that arc, which in retrospect is a bad idea. because it basically led to keeping Dad and Travis like purposefully in the dark in a way that we have not done before, nor was a way that I think they knew was possible.
Yeah.
We had to stop at one point because like Dad
was a bad fight.
It was bad. Dad was trying to like hold it together with the like narrative stuff that we knew that Phineas had to do. Travis was playing his character and like trying to like have an impact and be this like very coherent character. And those two things were kind of at odds with what Justin and I were doing, right? Which is inherently they were at odds because Justin was trying to fuck everything up and I was trying to encourage both things to happen while not giving away Justin's thing. It was straight up we got to the end of it and it was one of the worst, I would say, play experiences we had because nobody really felt like they were getting a fair end of the stick. Like we weren't playing the game or recording the show in the way that we always had. And so while I think that it is conceptually a neat idea, I definitely would have done it differently if we could go back and do that bit again.
I think it ended up being a really important object lesson in like the difference between like understanding the difference between like player knowledge and character knowledge, right? Because I think that's the thing that we ended up getting to is like, I think the reason it was hard to do both those things at the same time is that without that connection, without the player knowledge, we couldn't facilitate the story that was trying to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, I think that's what we ended up talking about is like, I think it ended up being a really cool kind of story concept and us playing this flashback and, oh man, I love everything from them like running to the ship trying to escape on.
Yeah.
Is like some of my favorite shit.
Which is, I think, when we had to stop and be like, okay, so here's what's happening. That's what the secret. I think around the time that the reveal happens is when we had to kind of stop and say, like, okay, so here's what me and Justin have been doing. We've been having sneaky texts in the background.
Yeah.
This is such an, like, doing what we do, especially with Taz, is such an exercise in trust. And like trusting your collaborators that like everyone's working towards the same thing and that you're going to be generous when you need to be. And I feel like that completely with the best of intentions, it hit so bad because it felt like a betrayal of that trust. Like,
yes,
we were not all creating something in the moment, but we're rather trying to lure two people into a trap that we had created outside of them. It's actually unhinged.
Now that yeah.
It's actually pretty demented, actually. It would be equivalent to if we were recording My Brother, and Me, and I just started chanting a 1,000-character-long series of numbers, and it's like, well, this is the show now, I guess.
Okay, did we join in, or is it pick our favorite number, or...?
Is that the one where I did the Ted Lasso voice?
Did you? Yeah, I don't know. You did kind of do a Ted Lasso voice for that. Yeah.
You tell me.
Well, then I enjoyed it.
Okay, good.
Can we talk about? We have a few questions here about the like character relationships, and I'm curious how you all felt about it because the relationships between, specifically, I would say Devo and Amber was definitely more contentious than we have had in past seasons, and Zook's there as a kind of like. Almost peacekeeper mediator. Like we have not had that before, but at the same time, I don't know that we've tried to play characters like the three characters you all played this season. And I'm curious, like what your thoughts on that experience was like, and like how those relationships kind of turned out.
With Amber and Devo, we came to that conflict fairly late. And in the arc, I think, and the source of that was this: I found Devo personally, from my perspective, to be so like very annoying, like very frustrating to be with, and like a frustrating character who's always like shooting his mouth off and like doing things that I found very frustrating. And then when I sort of like casually expressed this to Travis, he was like, well, yeah, that's like what I'm doing. You know what I mean? Like that is, it is a feature, not a bug. So what I did then was like allow the personal annoyance and frustration that I had with Devo to manifest through Amber. And like, it took me way too long to sort of pick up on what Travis was doing with Devo. And that, you know, is also a trust thing. I probably should have just like tried to buy in a little bit more earlier on. But like, that is certainly a, you know, why we came to that a little bit later is just because I didn't exactly pick up on that from the beginning.
A lot of the Devo frustration with Amber is I saw Devo very much as like an exposed nerve kind of thing. And Devo just really needed, wanted a mother figure approval thing. Especially coming off of his relationship with the Hand of Guidance. And that is not Amber's deal at all.
No.
So Devo started to get frustrated that Amber wasn't giving him what he needed. It was, I think, this thing of like, they're just different people. And I actually really like that. Let me make this clear, is like that frustration, at least for me, never extended like into the way me or Justin or Dad or anybody was playing it, right? I think it was just like, we, from the beginning, we never determined like, why are these three people together? It was almost like, well, we were all just in the waiting room at the same time. And they worked well together in that, like, the jobs got done in some form or fashion. But like, I think that these people felt more like coworkers than some of our past teams of people did. And yeah. I kind of really liked that. Like,
yeah, there's nothing wrong with
that. Yeah.
There's no, I at the same time, I understand people's, the folks who did not rock with that. I have no patience for the people who like used it as a springboard for, you know, armchair psychiatry on our familial relationship.
People do that?
I have no patience for that. I get gross. Not wanting to listen to a show that has that friction, right? There were times for me as the GM where that friction would serve as narrative friction to like, you know, there were times where I felt like you all were not necessarily working together to forward the mission because this friction existed between your characters. But at the same time, like, yeah, that's how friction works, right? I understand the people who did not necessarily enjoy that part of it, but anybody who thinks that it was something more than that or some reflection of the way that we make this show together, could not be. I would hope you would give us a little bit more credit than that at this point in the game.
We were raised Baptist, folks. If we ever have personal problems, you will never
know. Never
with
know.
get the Hubble, get the world's strongest microscope. It does not matter. You will not see it. Will we see it in each other? Perhaps not.
I don't know.
What chance do you have? My wife doesn't know how I feel half the time. You're going to get through your headphones? Okay.
In narrative, and as you know, since this is a storytelling podcast, we have to, I think we take it on ourselves when we embody these characters that we, you know, I think if it's all goody-goody, everybody gets along, everybody's holding hands, I think it gets boring after a while. The word is conflict, and there has to be conflict in a story. Now, you may not like interpersonal conflict, but to me, I think that was a defining, I mentioned it earlier, the fact that, yeah, we weren't all best buds, but when it came time to make a decision about the welfare of the others in the group, I think that gave those decisions more impact. Yeah. I mean, I think it made it, you know, mean
more. And
this
is the season where I think that tone makes the most sense. You have taken the remnants of humanity and like forced them all to live in a very small place. I think that the friction existing this season is it tracks.
I also think at least I won't speak for the other three, but for me, I was playing this as a much longer kind of game, and I think inspired by Quiet Year, where like I wasn't trying to rush like any kind of character development or inter-character development. And like if there had been a moment where the tensions between Devo and Amber had come to a head, I think we would have played it. It just didn't happen. But it also then provided for me when we got to like the end of season one of this thing of like, I'm going to kill a god, one, to stop magic, and two, so I can get more blood to open this thing so that Amber and I can finally figure this shit out. Like, that was, yeah, like, Devo's main driving goal is like, yeah, I want to save Amber, but mostly because, like, there's unresolved shit we got to figure out.
Right.
To me, it's not done. Like, that's the tension is part of the inspiration for continuing the action.
Season two, I don't have, like, that planned out necessarily. I do think you guys keep saying, Daniel says, you keep saying you'll return to Ethersea at some point, but with different characters. Does that mean you're treating Ethersea as more of an anthology series where each season we learn even more about the world just through the eyes of different characters? Like, yeah, I think that that's, I think the world changed during the first season, and the you three will play different characters in that world dealing with those changes.
Yeah.
But it will not be a fully standalone thing. But that said, like, I have not even begun to figure out like what that looks like. And
well, since Zooks got turned into Gigantor, I guess so.
Well, Zooks turned more into a Eva unit, like mecha shit, which I'm also
I think, and I don't want to speak too much on this because we haven't had these conversations much internally, but I feel like, Think less about what this means for Ethersea specifically, because I think this is a better reflection of like how we want to think about these worlds, like going forward. Like, we've made quite a few of them this time, and I don't think we necessarily want to start from scratch every single time we start a new arc.
Right.
So the idea that these are worlds we can return to rather than, you know, this sweeping epic that we do and then land perfectly and then never
return to again.
Return
until
to.
We do the graphic novel adaptation, until we
exactly
do the
right. The breakfast cereal, the toilet paper.
And so for the next season, we'll be doing all Sherlock Holmeses, and one of those, yeah, Sherlock Holmeses is a vampire for 85 episodes.
We don't have Ethersea season two planned out. We do have the next two things that we're doing settled on, and one of those things already fully recorded.
So before we get into that, the lead-in is we're going back to weekly. There will be a live show next week, which I think is just us two. That we did at San Diego Comic Con.
Y'all, the live show that ran this week was the Gorgon Ramsay one that I literally have ejected from my mind.
Yeah, completely forgotten.
Completely forgotten about
Lucas Haspenhide's art for it, and I was like, "Oh shit, yeah, okay."
Of Bobby Mindflay, and yeah, so
yeah. Good. And then starting after that live show, starting I believe September 1st, we're going back to Dust.
Yes.
We are doing. Yeah. We have 5 episodes: an episode 0 setup session, and then 4 episodes of Dust with guest star Erica Ishii.
Yeah, episodes 0 and 1 are going up on the same day.
Yeah.
And I don't know how necessary. I mean, it's up to you if you want to listen to 0 or not. We set up our characters and remind everybody the rules of Urban Shadows. But
yeah, I think you can start with 1.
Yeah, but I've listened to it. What else do you do? If you don't like listening to this podcast, then why do you listen to this podcast?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, so we're doing 4 episodes of that, Dust. It's already recorded. It's done. And frankly, I think it's top notch.
It's pretty fucking good.
It's good.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Good.
Can I say who I play in it?
Yeah, go for it.
I play Indrid Cold. The Mothman is in this one. The world's, the lines are blurring.
My fucking ultimate dream.
Yeah.
Of the Taziverse.
Yeah.
I got to come up with a better name for it.
It's all happening.
It's very fun. I think we're all playing new characters except for Juice.
Yeah, Justin plays Augustus.
Reprises Augustus Parsons. Yeah.
What about the Cat Sphere? Because the real connective tissue is cat salesman.
Yeah.
So we'll just call it the Fila. I'll come up with something.
The Philenium.
The Fillennium.
Ooh, that's good. This very last question is from Sierra. Justin, the people need to know, will you GM? Please, pretty please. I think it would be very fun, even just a short arc. You can take things fairly seriously, but on the surface are always looking for a joke, and I think it would be so amusing to even just do a one-off where the finale is like a punchline. You'd be so good at it.
That's from Sierra?
And so many others.
Okay.
Are you convinced him?
Yeah.
Sierra, we've been trying forever. You did it.
I'll do one after dust. Well, you didn't ask that kindly. You know what I mean? Like,
oh,
I'll do one after dust. Like, I very, like, know what it is and everything. I'll just do it after dust. It's fine. And we've
yeah, tell people.
The characters.
No, I don't want to tell them what it is.
What?
I mean, I'm not going to tell them what it
the
is.
Title? Tell
them what game system.
Yeah. Like, which, yeah, okay. Yeah. It's we're going to be playing Blades in the Dark.
By John Harper.
Thank you, Travis.
From Evil Hat Productions.
Thank you, Travis. Blades in the Dark, if you don't know, is a game about people who do crimes and do nasty things. Like, the player characters in this game are called scoundrels. Like, they're bad people and they do bad things. And this game is set in a fictional theme resort that is in scope exponentially larger than anything in our world. It is a massive theme city, if you will, a theme city state full of different theme parks within it. In much the same way that in Disney World you have like the Animal Kingdom and Epcot and things like that. These are massive theme parks within this city. It's all run by one family, and think like maybe there's a Westworld area, maybe there's a fantasy area, all that kind of stuff. It is a world that is replete with the ultra rich who are there living out their incredible fantasies. And our characters will be people who are just below the surface of that, who are trying to carve out a bit for themselves in this world. It's called Steeplechase. That's the name of the park and the arc, and it's gonna be nasty. It's gonna be, I have felt a little bit hemmed in by the fact that we started with like incredibly noble, decent heroes, and I feel like if there's one thing that's sort of like been consistent arc to arc with limited variance is that we have basically decent people who we are following. And that may end up being the case here. I'm not sure, but there was an irreverence to early balance where it felt like you could just kind of murder people and it wasn't like a big deal. And I want to push people out of that comfort zone. I want to push these three out of that comfort zone and start to get into a little bit of the old nastiness as we used to say in college. So it's going to be a nasty story about nasty people in a fantastically beautiful world that none of us could ever afford. So that's Steeplechase, and it'll be coming after Dust Part 2.
And Blades in the Dark is a brilliant system, like heist game system.
It's weird that we've never done it before. It's so on brand for our stuff.
Yeah.
I wanted to say real quick, too, before I forgot, Urban Shadows is the game system for Dust. It is written by Andrew Medeiros and Mark Diaz Truman. It's by Magpie Games. Yep. And it's incredible. One of my favorite ones to ever exist.
So that's it. A month of Dust, and then on to Steeplechase, which will be a bigger season. I don't think Juice is... I don't know that we've talked so much about the scale of it, but it is... We are not...
23 episodes.
That's if you get the season 2 pickup, right?
Yeah. Well, if you pay for all the bonus.
Yeah.
We have some... A lot of times it says there's like 27 episodes. 5 of that is just like behind the scenes.
And there's some web exclusives that you're only going to get. Yeah,
making nubs.
On Quibi.
That's it for this edition of TTAS. I want to say a huge thank you to everybody who got into Ethersea this season. I've never been so invested in like a world we have created as quickly as I was with this one, and I'm so proud of it and really happy with how it turned out. And thank you all for listening and for listening.
I wanted to say something real quick for it, because I don't know if we'll do a TTAS like soon. But I just want to say how excited we were to work with Eric Ishii on Dust.
Yeah.
If nothing else, like it already makes it one of my favorite things we've done. And it was just so nice to work with somebody who like responded to my emails quickly and like answered character
questions.
All right,
questions, thanks for listening, everybody. Here it is. Here comes that real fight. That real fight that we talked.
This is it.
Remember, what's our safe word? the fighting's too real. Thanks as always for listening to us. You know, with these two new things coming up, if you enjoy Taz, this is weird. We like never talk about this, but if you would like tell some people, like, hey, you know, remember you've said listen to that podcast a bunch and you said it's not for you. Well, they're doing something different. Maybe you'll like that. You know what I mean? Like, just that helping spread the word about the show we appreciate it.
Yep.
So if you enjoy it, you know, please do that.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.